Russian President Vladimir Putin makes a surprise visit to Mariupol, his first trip to the Ukrainian city since it was captured by Russia. French police clash with protesters in Paris and Nantes amid the anger over the government's decision to push through its pension reform bill. And more than a dozen people are killed and many buildings are destroyed following a powerful earthquake that hit parts of Ecuador and Peru. Welcome to World News Live from the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Russian president has made a surprise visit to Mariupol, his first trip to the Ukrainian city since it was captured after a lengthy siege at the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Vladimir Putin flew to Mariupol by helicopter and took a tour of the city. He visited several sites and spoke with residents. Putin's stop in Mariupol comes after a surprise visit to Crimea to mark the 9th anniversary of the peninsula's annexation. The trips came after an arrest warrant was issued for Putin by the International Criminal Court over Russia's alleged deportation of thousands of Ukrainian children. The Kremlin has dismissed as void the validity of the warrant. Joining us for more on that is Marina Kurtanova, our correspondent in the Russian capital, Moscow, and also Tim Kirby, radio host and political analyst, also from Moscow. Marina, if I could start with you. So quite an unexpected visit by Putin, first to Crimea and now to Mariupol.
Well, it is. It may be unexpected for foreigners, but not for Russians. First of all, I want to mention that yesterday Russian president arrived in Crimea, and it was the day of the 9th anniversary of the peninsula's reunification in Russia. So the president's schedule was devoted to the situation on the peninsula, and he held a meeting devoted to the socio-economic development of Crimea and Sevastopol, and he took part in the opening of a significant cultural and historical site. Then Putin has paid a working visit to Mariupol to inspect a number of locations in the city and to talk to local residents. So he traveled to Mariupol in a helicopter and there drove a vehicle along the city's streets, making stops at several locations. So during the trip, President listened to a detailed report about reconstruction works in the city and its outskirts. In particular, the report concerned the construction of new residential districts, social and educational facilities, utility infrastructure, and medical centers. So the president talked to residents of the, if I'm not mistaken, Nevsky district and visited an apartment upon an invitation from a family living there. And it was the Russian president's first ever visit to Donbas. This may be really surprising. So at the moment, Mariupol residents that left the city earlier due to fighting have been actively returning with growth of the population registered. So jobs are being created in the city and each enterprise has been spelled out how much, who invests, what source, who is in charge, how much jobs should be created. So this year's task for the heating season is to efficiently heat all ruined facilities. There are 1,829 facilities in total, must all be fully heated. So there is a huge program for this year. Putin also visited Mariupol port, which is in good condition, and it is starting to function as a construction and transshipment base. The ports of Mariupol and Berdyansk would be engaged in cargo traffic during the navigation season this year, but it is premature to talk about the development of passenger traffic yet. After Mariupol, Russian president visited command post of special military operation, where he in Rostov-on-Don, where he listened to the reports of the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, and a number of military leaders.
Tim, what do you make of the Russian leader's trip to what is essentially a war zone?
Definitely a show of strength if you look at it from one standpoint, because it means he wasn't afraid to fly by helicopter somewhat on the edge of the war zone. Now, we have to remember that if we watch the news, I'm not a military expert, but I can tell you that Donetsk continues to get hit by the Ukrainians. Mariupol does not. So Mariupol seems to be either slightly outside their range or outside their scope of operations. And that's one of the reasons why the reconstruction works are taking place there so rapidly, because apparently they're not going to be knocked right back down again. So although it's a bit outside of the true danger zone, it is definitely a risky maneuver, especially if certain three-letter organizations from the West have good access to Russian information. So it's definitely a show that the president is not afraid to travel to the Donbass to get close to the war zone, even by helicopter. So we could interpret it that way. And furthermore, it's hard to sort of explain, again, as was mentioned before, to a sort of foreign audience, but the Crimean referendum was very much a turning point in Russian history. And so at the very least, the president's journey to the Crimea was, first off, it wasn't his first to celebrate the anniversary. It certainly won't be the last, because this was a major change in the direction of Russia as a nation, and it was generally perceived as a very positive change in direction.
Right. You know, Tim, before the war started, there were many Western mainstream reporters shedding tears, not crocodile tears, real tears, over the Ukrainian military's attacks against ethnic Russians in the east, in the country's east. What changed now after the war?
Well, the politics, I think, changed. We've seen many, many screenshots, videos, pieces of analysis that show that around the 2014-2015 mark, especially from, say, the British or American press, that Ukraine was being built up into some sort of neo-Nazi hellhole. Well, somewhere around 2021-2022, that sort of all became forgotten or pushed under the table or swept under the rug would be the better expression. You see, the attitude changed because it would seem that someone in the Western media got the signal that this has gotten serious and that we need to support Ukraine no matter what type of people are actually there. So it really is yet another piece of evidence that shows how the Western press is essentially a propaganda arm of the institutions that fund it. So, yeah, that's pretty much the way it breaks down. The facts, according to the media, had to match the political objectives, especially in Washington and London.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guest. Marina Kurtanova is our correspondent in the Russian capital, Moscow. Tim Kirby is a radio host and political analyst, also joining us from the Russian capital. Moving on, Kosovo blames Serbia for the failure to sign a landmark EU brokered deal to normalize relations.
The other side, just as in the last meeting in Brussels on 27th of February, is avoiding signing the agreement, now also with the annex. It is now up to the European Union to find the mechanism to make the status of this agreement legally and internationally binding.
Albin Kurti made the remarks after a trilateral meeting with his Serbian counterpart and the EU foreign policy chief in North Macedonia. Separately, Serbian president said both sides have reached some sort of agreement, but the implementation plan will definitely have to be upgraded. The EU has described the negotiations as difficult. Last month, Kosovo and Serbia agreed to a deal to normalize relations following nearly 10 years of EU-mediated talks. French police have clashed with protesters for the third straight day as anger mounts over President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms. Rallies were held in several cities across the country. In the capital, Paris, police banned protests outside the parliament after gatherings there the two previous nights led to clashes between demonstrators and security forces. On Thursday, Macron invoked a controversial executive power to force through a bill on the state pension age without a parliamentary vote. The move has also angered the political class, presenting the 45-year-old leader with one of his biggest challenges less than a year into his second and final mandate. Opposition lawmakers have filed two motions of no confidence in the government, which are to be debated in Parliament on Monday. Moving on now, Kazakhstan is holding a snap parliamentary elections. 12 million people are eligible to vote. Seven political parties are participating in the vote. Independent candidates are allowed to run for the first time in nearly two decades. A 30% quota has also been introduced for women, young people and people with disabilities. President Kasym Jomart Tokayev dissolved parliament in January and announced the early vote as part of what has been called a modernization drive. The decision was made following last year's deadly protests against fuel prices. However, critics accused the Central Asian country's president of trying to consolidate power by such reforms. Elsewhere, at least 13 people are killed in a strong earthquake that jolted a coastal region in southern Ecuador. The government said the 6.8 magnitude earthquake left 11 people dead in the province of El Hierro and two fatalities in Azuay province. It added that multiple homes, educational buildings and health centers were also damaged. The earthquake also shook Peru. Peruvian authorities said that the quake was felt in the country's northern region, claiming the life of a four-year-old girl. A pro-Syria sit-in has been held in Rome and in a number of capitals across the world as part of a campaign called End the Siege. The initiative was in solidarity with the Syrian people who are suffering from the sanctions imposed on their country by the West.
On Saturday, sit-ins were held in several countries across the world as part of a campaign aimed at denouncing the devastating effects of the sanctions imposed by the US and the European Union on Syria. The initiative, named End the Siege, has been joined by organizations based in a dozen countries, including Jordan, Palestine, Lebanon, the UK, Germany, and Canada. Italy's sit-in was held in Rome in front of the Colosseum, where members of the No War Network and the U.S. Citizens for Peace and Justice denounced how U.S. and EU sanctions have devastated Syria's economy and led to immense human suffering. Demonstrators at the sit-in said that the U.S. must leave Syria and stop profiting from Syrian oil and wheat that has exacerbated the poverty in the country. Italy and Syria once maintained a robust relationship, but in 2012, 1 year after the Syrian conflict, Rome joined its Western allies in closing its embassy in Damascus. 7 years later, in 2019, when Italy had an anti-establishment government under the leadership of the Five Star Movement and the Northern League, it appeared that Rome was mulling over normalizing relations with Damascus and reopening its embassy there. However, something went wrong. The February 6 earthquake has further worsened the already deteriorating economy and humanitarian situation in Syria. According to UN sources, even before the earthquake tragedy, 70% of the population needed humanitarian assistance due to the war in the country and the US-EU sanctions. Max Civili, Rome.
Now, tens of thousands of people hit the streets of Tel Aviv for the 11th consecutive week against the policies of new Israeli far-right cabinets. Similar protests also took place in the settlement of Haifa, occupied Al-Quds, the settlement of Beersheba, and hundreds of other towns and cities across the occupied Palestinian territories. The protesters are angry at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. If approved, the legislation would increase the cabinet's influence in choosing judges and limit the powers of the Supreme Court to overturn the cabinet's decisions. Critics argue that the legal changes will foster corruption and bring diplomatic isolation. The reforms are the cornerstone of Netanyahu's cabinet, an alliance of ultra-Orthodox and extreme right-wing parties which took office in late December. Meanwhile, Hamas's deputy chief says the Palestinian resistance movement will file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. Musa Abu Marzouk says the regime must be held to account for its war crimes against Palestinians. Abu Marzouk pointed to the four Israeli wars on the Gaza Strip as well as desecrations of Palestinian holy sites, demolition of their homes, and confiscation of their lands. These, he said, constitute war crimes that should be prosecuted. Marzouk was addressing a conference against occupation. The regime has recently intensified its crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The violence has left 89 Palestinians dead so far this year. Saudi Arabia conducts new attacks on Yemen, leaving three more civilians dead and several others injured in the northwestern province of Sa'da. Two of the victims lost their lives in an artillery attack on the border district of Sha'da. Six other people were also wounded in gunfire and shellings in the same district. In a separate attack, Saudi-led forces also killed a man in the district of Munaba. Riyadh, along with some regional allies and backed by the U.S., launched the war on Yemen back in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Years of aerial strikes and shelling, as well as a blockade by the Saudi-led coalition, have devastated the country and left hundreds of thousands of civilians dead.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Nowruz celebration of New Iranian calendar year to all Iranians and all Farsi-speaking people around the world. I, on behalf of IRIB English Radio staff, congratulate you at the beginning of spring.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of first to sixth. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, March 19th, 2023. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. And as you may know, we are just 2 days away from Nowruz, the start of the new Iranian year and the start of actually spring. Congratulations, everyone, on the occasion of Nowruz and the start of spring. Welcome back, everyone. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Special is your program, as we always say. It's your views that are important. And as usual, we've received reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world. For reception reports, we've received reception reports from Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Reginaldo Naldi from Brazil, and Juan Antonio Bertolin from Spain. So, Mizanur Rahman, Reginaldo, and Juan Antonio, thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio and your favorite program, Listeners Special. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us at IRIB English Radio because actually these reception reports enable us to provide a better service, a high quality service for our great listeners around the world. And all of you who have sent in reception reports will be receiving an electronic QSL from us. And let's go to see who has sent us emails from around the world. Ramin Aminizad from Iran has sent us a piece of email and a congratulations message. From Italy, we've received an email from Nico Genovese, one of our old and regular listeners. And from India, we have an email from Jayanta Chakrabarty, one of our old and regular listeners. Again from India, we've received an email from Bithan Chandra Sanyal. We will be back with you. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and most of our emails and letters we've received today are focused on Nowruz and your beautiful congratulation message. So Ramin Aminizad from Iran has sent us an email. Let's see what he says. Happy Nowruz to IRIB English Radio staff, to the Iranian listeners, as well as foreign listeners of your service who celebrate this occasion. I hope the world in the upcoming year will be full of peace and prosperity for all human beings. I would like to thank you, IRIB, very much for helping me to improve my yet broken English and your informative broadcast. Wish you all the best. So, first of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Ramin Aminizad from Iran, and thank you very much for sending this Nowruz congratulation message to IRIB English Radio staff, as well as the Iranian and foreign listeners of IRIB English Radio. So please accept our electronic QSL as verification, Ramin Aminizad. Please write to us soon and tell us your views about our broadcast. We also wish you all the best, Ramin Aminizad from Iran. We've received an email from Nico Genovese from Italy, one of our regular listeners. Nico says, "Dearest friends, I send you a sincere wish for a happy Iranian New Year. Although the Italian language program is no longer broadcast on the radio, I often listen to your programs in other languages. I also try to and monitor the signal level whenever possible. I have also sent some reception reports in the past. I will continue to follow you with esteem and interest. A warm greeting from Italy." Salam and warm greetings from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to you, Nico Genovese from Italy. Thank you very much for this email and for your Nowruz congratulation message. It was it's really good to hear that you often listen to IRIB English Radio programs. Thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. Thanks for being a friend of us at IRIB English Radio, and be sure that we are also with you. Wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification. Nico Genoves from Italy. And from India, we've received an email from one of our old and regular listeners, from Jayanta Chakrabarty. Jayanta Chakrabarty says, "Thank you, dear producer, for your kind message. Like previous years, I am preparing an audio recording along with text message of greetings on the happy occasion of Nowruz for IRIB English listeners. This colorful welcome to spring is celebrated by Indian Shia Muslims, Iranian communities residing in India, and by Parsis. Warm greetings. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, and appreciations to you for this beautiful congratulation message on Nowruz. We also wish you all the best. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification." We have another email from India, but this time from Bithan Chandra Sanyal. Bithan Chandra Sanyal says, "First of all, on the occasion of Nowruz, I would like to express my sincere love and best wishes to all the staff and listeners of IRIB, the state radio broadcasting organization of the Islamic Republic of Iran. May Nowruz bring welfare and prosperity to the entire world, including Iran. I pray to the most merciful creator. As I know, Nowruz is the Iranian New Year celebrated according to the Iranian solar calendar. This festival is the beginning of the Persian New Year. The word Nowruz means new day in Persian. May all the impurities, sadness, and disappointment of the old days be washed away from our lives, and may the life flow of creativity and innovation develop into a better, successful, and fruitful human life. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and from IRIB English Radio staff to you, Bithan Chandra Sanyal from India. Thank you very much for your beautiful and nice congratulation message for Nowruz, as well as your great and thoughtful prayer. We also wish you all the best and wish you all the good things in the world. And of course, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And all the views and opinions about IRIB English Radio programs are welcomed always. Bithan Chandra Sanyal from India, thank you again. Please accept our electronic QSL as verification. And here we come to the end of our today's program. Many thanks for being with us. As I said earlier in the program, we are just 2 days away from Nowruz, the start of the Iranian New Year and the spring. Many thanks for your congratulation messages. Many thanks to Juan Antonio Bertolin from Spain, Reginaldo Naldi from Brazil, Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Ramin Aminizad from Iran, Nico Genoves from Italy, Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, and Bithan Chandra Sanyal from India. Thank you for your reception reports, emails, and your congratulation messages. Please keep in touch with us. We wish you all the best. Goodbye and God bless you.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A move that has caused anger and outrage across France. The French President Emmanuel Macron has used his executive power to push the retirement age from 62 to 64. He says it is necessary to avoid the system from slipping into a deficit. Well, the French are not buying it. Such is the case with the opposition, which have filed two motions of no confidence in the government. Was Macron's move out of necessity? And how democratic was this move? Just two of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. John Busnish, I'll first start with you. We're looking at this reform, obviously, that you're well aware of. The government reasons for that, necessary to avoid the system from slipping into a deficit. That's what they said, which, according to the Macron's government, would put France in line with its European neighbors, where the legal retirement age is typically higher. Are you buying Macron's reasoning here?
Of course not. First of all, anytime you hear a government use the word reform, what they're actually saying is cutbacks. Cutbacks in services that they promised you, cutbacks in services that you already paid for. So the word reform is a code word for government failure. That's number one. Number two, a pension is a contract in which a person contributes money to an investment plan that the government monitors and guarantees for you, and that contract has two parties. No one party is legally able to cancel a contract without paying an indemnity. That's not happening in this case. So what's happened here is the French government has mismanaged the money that the French workers have introduced and paid into the system, and instead of accepting its mismanagement and cutting its expenditures elsewhere to cover the loss, they're trying to punish the people who properly, voluntarily, and in good faith contributed to the system. So any kind of pension reform, so-called pension reform, is called the real definition is government failure.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, what do you think about that? What we heard from our guest there, John Busnish, is that these cutbacks are things that the French have already paid for, and in particular what he said there at the end, that there's been mismanagement of money which is spent elsewhere. When it comes to pensions, that seems to be typical, correct?
Well, there is some of this, but there are much more element into this riots and manifestation that are happening in Paris and in other cities around France. So first of all, we have to understand that Macron has been elected by only 23% of the voters on the first round. And the French agreed to elect Macron because they were between a very bad choice and even worse choice between him and Marine Le Pen, and they didn't want to vote for the extreme right-wing candidate. This is already not giving Macron in the second mandate the majority at the National Assembly that he enjoyed in the, on the first mandate. Secondly, there is the COVID that crippled the economy in Europe and elsewhere, and the decision of the European leaders to close down everything and then turn out that it was not the right move, that crippled the economy and the government needed to borrow money. France is under more than 8.9 trillion euros deficit. Another point is going to support the war in Ukraine and sending more than $60 billion from the European side, because there are another 60 from the American side. That also, I agree with the mismanagement of the asset, because not buying a cheap gas from Russia that used to reach us here in Europe with 30% less, and now we have to buy it, not only pay back the 30%, but also paying an additional 4 times the price of gas to America and Norway, that has crippled the economy, where the French government needed to compensate the individual, not the society, not the companies, but the individual, to a certain point that costed the government around 16 billion euros. So all these elements added to the pressure on the government that is saying, well, I need either to increase the taxes or to raise the pension age. And by increasing the taxes, the government will be faced with another problem, because the Americans have the gas that is cheaper, and because they offering subsidies, we've seen the migration of many European companies and the big multinationals leaving Europe, going to the U.S., Had we maintained the price of gas and the flow of gas from Russia, there was a possibility to increase the taxes on the big companies and for these big companies to remain in Europe and pay the taxes.
Yeah, that last point that you made there, John Bustos, what do you think of that? It almost sounds, based on the fact that if you apply for a tax increase on these companies, that they would go the route that many have already from Europe, in particular from Germany, and those are the green rebates, so to speak, where U.S. has offered, of which, again, some multinationals from Europe have actually gone to the U.S. for. Was France left with any options other than raising this retirement age?
France has every possible option. They're running an immense deficit, And that immense deficit is partly due to France's prioritization of maintaining its pseudo-empire. France continues to have military forces in Africa. France continues to try to project military power around the world as if they were still the empire of the Bourbon and Napoleonic eras. France has an identity complex, a political identity complex, and they have bankrupted themselves by trying to keep up the facade of being the France that they once were. Therefore, when they want to try to project power that they don't have, they take that power from the weakest members of their society. Those are normally the pensioners. And luckily for the pensioners, there are other elements of the society that are very upset now with the way the French government functions. And that includes the yellow vests. That includes the people who have objected to the COVID craziness. That includes the people who have read the reports that masks don't work. That includes the people who read the reports that the vaccines don't work, and so on. And so what we've got is a focus of all of these complaints on one spot. And the younger members of society are saying, why are we punishing these aged members, our parents, who worked all their lives in traditional jobs, many of them state jobs, where the government was not only profiting from your work, but also taking a pension fund deduction from your work. So they were profiting from you in two ways: the profit of the state corporation in which you worked, and the deduction from your salary for the pensions. The government has failed here. The French government has to cut back their military imperialism, and they have to use that money instead of making wars in Ukraine and making wars in Africa. They've got to use that money for their own people. That's the crux of the crisis in France. And Macron is nothing more than an American-led puppet regime in France. And the American system is to privatize everything when it doesn't work and let the poor suffer. That's their solution.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, one of the things that has angered many French, if you agree with it, Elijah Magnier, is the way that the and the manner in which this bill was approved. From what we understand, they sidestepped a vote in the country's lower house, and that angered many because not only does it put the notion of democracy into question, it's as if it puts Emmanuel Macron into this position where he rules, which many of those placards in the protest equated him with being a dictator. Isn't that also one of the sources of anger that's out there to have caused this controversy?
Is that a question for me?
No, that's for Elijah Magnier. I'm sorry, John. Go ahead, Elijah.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, using Elisabeth Borne, the prime minister, to use the constitutional clause 49.3 and to dismiss the vote of the parliament is due because Macron understood that all the Gaullists and the centrists will not support his vote, particularly with the people manifesting in the street. So using this clause is something that happened in the past at least 90 times in the history of France. However, it is a very unpopular decision. It is a legal decision. It is a constitutional decision, but it's not a democratic one. With that, I do agree, because he should have allowed the parliament to vote, but he has used his right. However, there are way out. I mean, I remember in 2006 when Jacques Chirac used also the same constitutional clause, and then he had to double down. But for that, there are consequences. And the consequences is either Macron is going to dismiss the prime minister after tomorrow, because the prime minister is facing with the government the confidence vote, or he needs to dissolve the entire National Assembly and then later on resign, because he knows that he's not going to get the majority, because he has decided to take the road of a very unpopular decision to raise the age. Now, raising the age from 62 to 64, looking at it from the outside, particularly in Europe, Europeans think this is not a big deal, because in other countries we have age of 65, 67, even in Italy, and they thinking of pushing it to the age of 70. However, we see the advantage of the rich people or those who have gone to university and are educated, and they spend between 7 to 11 years studying, and then started to work at the age of 27 to 31, while the poor people and with a different background and different means, they've started to work at the age of 16 to 18. So by the age of 62, they have already done their 42 years and even 43 and 44 years of work, and they think this is not possible for them to work for another 2 years. Now, there is something in the French mentality that we need to understand, that the French take for granted anything that they have reached in the past. So in the past, the hours per week were 45, they were reduced to 40, and now they are 35 hours per week. And they're not ready to move and to work even more per week for the same wages. Now they have the 62 age of retirement, and they're not going to let go because there is a problem. The problem is the amount of wage we're getting on our pension, and that vary between 900 to 1,400. This is not enough to pay the rent and pay the bills. This is what the French and the other Europeans as well are facing, sure, with the wrong investment that Europe has made.
Okay, that's a point that needs to be discussed here, because we're looking at these protests, John Busnich, to have garnered some of the largest crowds. One of them was 1.5 million. And then looking at the opinion polls, just one of them, which actually mirrors many of the other opinion polls, shows that around two-thirds of the French people actually oppose this reform. Shouldn't the government be worried about not only the number of protests that take place, which really brings places like Paris to a standstill practically in terms of its economy, but also just in terms of the large crowds that are showing up? In the past few days, we've seen that it has turned violent, reminiscent of the Yellow Vest protests that took place.
Yes. Well, in fact, the French government is obviously worried, and Macron himself is seriously worried, because he intervened to interrupt the democratic process, as your other guest pointed out, and rightly so. Macron is actually suspending the democracy that the French people fought for. They didn't just adopt democracy in France. They fought for it with guns, and they overthrew a monarchy, and they created a democratic state, which is far more democratically oriented than the United States, which was really a shift of power between ruling elites. In France, they made a democracy in which the people decided that, you know, we live once, and we want to work 35 hours a week so that they have the rest of the time for their family. They eat better, they socialize better, they have better music, they have better social interaction among themselves. That's a characteristic of French society. And when the French people say, you know, we'd like to live a little bit after our jobs end, and we want to live our, let's say, 15 years after age 62 until we die, and live those years with our grandchildren and with our families, that means something in France, because the family unit still exists in France, whereas in the United States, the idea of family has been destroyed by companies that take your son to California and take your daughter to New York, and you live in Missouri. So this is a cultural difference, and the French are in all of these demonstrations defending their essential identity, their culture, against the capitalization of their lives. And that's why this is an issue. It's not just an issue of plus or minus 2 years. It's an issue of freedom as defined by the French Revolution.
Yeah, they're very passionate about that. There's no questions there, Elijah Magnier. We've seen how the French come out almost at anything that they feel that they oppose in terms of any kind of government initiatives, and they come out in droves, as we have seen. But when you really take a look at some of these protests, especially the recent ones, obviously, it's not just about this pension reform, is it? I think you mentioned, Elijah, in your last statements, that this is also about what many European countries are grappling with, and that's a cost of living crisis, because it's not just about the pension reform. You said something about rent, which was 900 euros, I guess it has gone up to 1,100. But across the board, we're looking at increases in the cost of living, generally speaking, food we could also mention. Isn't that the case, that that's why this just added more pain to their misery?
It is. I mean, the prices today of food are really ridiculous. But every day there is an increase of prices. You can't believe that we pay for, I mean, I don't buy it anymore. I take a selfie next to it, but a kilo of tomato here costs $9. That is 8.5 euros. This is ridiculous price, and every day there is an increase. The rent is increasing. The cost of life is increasing. The value of the money is decreasing. It is no longer possible to live in this situation in Europe, and this is what the French are saying, and the other Europeans are saying. Well, even if we retire at the age of 62 or 64 or even 67, what's going to happen to us? The problem is now the Europe is offering a good health service that is giving the more possibility for people to live longer. So they're not stopping to work at the age of 62 or 64 because the pension is no longer enough to survive and pay the bills. And all these decisions taken by Europe to see ourselves dragged into a war that falls in the interest only of the U.S. administration and nothing in the interest of the European population, this is something that Europe is going to pay the price. And the price is we see today in the street, because France, it's a republic monarchy, it's not a democracy. That needs to be clear. People are starting to talk about decapitation of Macron. Well, because they bring back the memory of Louis the 16 and the French Revolution. But this revolution, we've seen people in the street. You mentioned 1.3 or 1.5 million. The syndicate said there were 3.8 million. So these figures, okay, they're nothing confirmed, but between the Interior Ministry and the syndicate, there are millions in the street. There are hundreds of thousands in Germany. There are hundreds of thousands in Spain, in Greece, in Italy, everywhere. And it's not because of the pension only. It is not the gilets jaunes. It is also the investment that Europe is investing in the war for the U.S., on behalf of the U.S. And we continue taking decisions that are unpopular for the population, that are incompatible with the interests of the Europeans. Sure. And we are suffering the consequences, and we don't understand why. There is a huge gap between the leaders and the population.
Yeah, let's talk about that gap. But in particular, let's talk about the game plan John Bussenstedt Macron may have here. It appears that he's just trying to feel things out right now. He pushed the reform through, but he wants to see how things are going to pretty much transpire. I mean, the angle that I'm looking at here, you have different sectors that are striking, like the garbage strikes. We know has created havoc in the capital, Paris. We know in the energy sector, just the recent news on that is that the CGT union has said strikers would halt production at two refineries by this weekend or Monday at the latest. There was before a halt in gas production where we saw what happened. People were queuing up for gas. This goes back a few months. And we also know that there's a national train operator that's supposed to have urged workers to continue their strike. That's going to cause major disruptions. But if this spreads across different sectors beyond the ones that I just mentioned, wouldn't that impact the economy to the point where the French president may have to rethink of this pension reform? Is that a possibility? In 2019, the high fuel prices, if you remember that, Macron was forced into a U-turn on carbon tax. Do you think there's a possibility this may happen?
Absolutely, absolutely. As soon as the strikes head to the health sector and to the educational sector, as soon as the teachers, as soon as the teachers stop coming out to teach the students and the students are staying at home, and as soon as a person cannot go to get medical treatment, then the system is finished and Macron will have to resign. And it's just a question of the unions deciding if they want to take it to that level at this point. Do they have that level of public support? And I think it's pretty well understood. I mean, I studied in France for several years. I speak French. I read French media. And I can tell you that the French people are fed up and large proportion of the French people realize that their president is an American puppet, not just in the war on Russia, but in the way the economy is being transformed into an American-style command capitalist economy, not a mixed socialist and capitalist economy. And this is an essential attack on the culture of France. And Macron, if he keeps on pushing it, and he hits the school system, and he hits especially the medical system, then he's finished. And that, I'm sure, is what the unionists are organizing to provoke him into doing. Because Macron is going to do what he's ordered to do by the Americans, and the Americans have no mercy. And they will order him to do it, he will do as ordered, and he will fall.
Okay, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you very much for that. John Busnish, journalist and political analyst, and also Elijah Magnier. Thank you for your input from Brussels, journalist and political analyst there. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Color of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Our special guest speaker for today's discussion from the Islamic House of Qom is Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
All right, Brother Suhail, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of tabliq, preaching Islam during the holy month of Ramadan. We know that in this holy month, so many muballigh, so many preachers, disseminators, of the Islamic teachings are sent here and there in order to talk about Islam, the Holy Quran, the importance of the holy month of Ramadan. And now for today's discussion, we want to talk about especially the role that the women have in this tabligh. Can a lady or a woman be a muballigha in the holy month of